Hello and welcome to the very first episode of 4AD Forages, a podcast that will be exploring the worlds of the extended 4AD family. We're delighted to have Genevieve McGuckin and Janine Standish discussing their overlapping lives with Roland S. Howard for this first show. Long-term 4AD fans will need little introduction to Roland, as he was the guitarist of 1980s band The Birthday Party. Janine Standish is one half of Australian band Hate Rock and worked with Roland in his later life. Genevieve was Roland's partner in love and music for many years. She was in These Immortal Souls alongside Roland, Harry Howard and Kevin Godfrey. I'll leave Janine and Genevieve to fill you in on the rest.
Hello, my name's Genevieve McGuckin and I was a long-time cohort of Roland S. Howard. We met in 1977. I co-wrote a couple of songs for The Birthday Party. We played together in a band called These Immortal Souls for about, I don't know, 12 years or something. And I'm a member of Pop Crimes, a band that does Roland songs so that people can continue to listen to them live, which has been fantastic. And I played with Roland on Lydia Lunch's
Some Velvet Morning.
Yep. Not Lydia Lunch's.
I love that record.
Lydia Lunch and Roland, and was with Barry Adamson and Mick Harvey and myself, and that was a lot of fun. And we came back last year from a tour where we played in Paris and London with Pop Crimes, and with us on that tour was Janine Standish, and she's here with me. Hi, Janine.
Hello. Hello, my name's Janine Standish, and I guess I'm a short cohort friend of Roland's. I think I was friends with Roland for maybe six lovely years, and he produced or co-produced my debut album with my band Hate Rock called Marry Me Tonight. And I did a duet with Roland called I Know a Girl Called Johnny.
Which he wrote for Johnny.
About Johnny. we were trying to write about each other. But that's a long story. We'll get to that. And what else did we do? Oh, Sean also played bass on that song too, my bandmate at the time from Hate Rock. I'm also in the Pop Crimes band. I'm a singer, and I'm also the backstage vibe master.
Oh, and I forgot to say I play keyboards.
Yes. Yeah, I should have. Genevieve plays keyboards, and you also play acoustic guitar.
I do, yeah.
And you are, may I say, the only woman repping on the instruments, and you play every single song, and it's about a four-hour show.
I know. I had to get steroid injections in my knuckles at one stage so I could keep going. A martyr to music.
For you listeners, if you haven't heard of the Pop Crimes band, Pop Crimes was Roland's last solo album. And the Pop Crimes band is a group of friends and collaborators who play a vast amount of Roland songs. And they're incredible songs, and he only made two solo albums, didn't he?
Yeah.
And also you play a lot of songs from These Immortal Souls.
Yeah.
And the whole team of collaborators is always leaves the show blown away by the quality of these songs.
Yeah, it's just like what every single song
every
in the set
there's
is
no,
fantastic.
There's no filler. Yeah. It's absolutely wild. And there's not one song that everyone thinks, oh, we'll just get through this. It's like every song is a real joy to watch and play every night. And so, yeah.
It's an amazing experience.
Yeah.
To do it and to experience these songs. And sometimes it's like, oh, what would Roland think?
Yeah. I know we do have a couple of little sneaky conversations backstage about what Roland would think. It can go mostly in a favourable direction.
Yeah.
Mostly. And
really?
We are recording together. We're having this conversation at my home in the Dandenong Ranges in Melbourne.
It's beautiful. It's in the middle of the forest and it's sort of got two studios, really, sort of.
Yeah, we've got the Hate Rock headquarters studio, which is my band, and my husband Conrad is in a band called CS and Cream. He's a really dear old friend of Roland's as well. He might come and interrupt us with some anecdotes.
He gave the eulogy at Roland's funeral, such a good friend, and was one of the pallbearers.
There's a lot of love for Roland in this house, and there's also a Roland S. Howard skateboard.
I've got one of those.
So, yeah, Conrad might pop in, you never know.
I've got a Roland S. Howard street sign. Do you have a copy of the street sign? They gave me one.
Really?
Yeah.
That was wild. So Roland and Genevieve lived on Eildon Road.
In St Kilda, Melbourne.
Genevieve, you still live in St Kilda?
I do. I still live about sort of 100 yards away from where we were. Yeah.
And can you tell me a little bit about Roland S. Howard Lane?
Roland S. Howard Lane is a lane that connects two streets, a street where we lived in Eildon Road and Jackson Street in St Kilda. And it's a beautiful laneway, very long. It sort of goes from Juji end to the Paris end to the slummy
end of St Kilda.
Tenement end. And it wasn't called anything, and
did it just have no name at all from memory?
It had no name. It had a sort of name that apparently ambulance people used to call it, Jackson Lane, but it was never actually.
I thought you were going to say something like Dead Body Lane.
Dead Body Lane. Yeah, there was a bit of that. But we petitioned the council and to get it named after Roland, and much to our surprise, they were really into the idea. And the local member of parliament got involved, and press got involved. Nick wrote a letter to the newspaper. And all these people like Sonic Youth and lots of overseas musicians put their weight behind it, and they'd never had so many signatures for any petition in the history of the council.
My signature was on there too.
But I think Roland would find it hilarious that he had a street named after him.
I think there was talk amongst his friends to make a gold life-size statue of Roland smoking a cigarette in the lane at some point, backstage conversation.
That would be great, yeah. As long as it had no pigeons on it, because he hated pigeons. We'd have to have a cat on his shoulder would be perfect.
A cat is anti-pigeon. Mm.
But I'm sure the council would have hated the idea of a cigarette, unfortunately.
Yeah, even a gold cat.
Yeah.
Was it Noonie?
Yeah, Noonie.
Lived to, Genevieve was just telling me over coffee this morning, Jen, your cat and Roland's cat you shared together.
Yes,
you
shared custody.
You shared custody of Noonie that you brought back from London.
Yes, we brought her back from London. Roland saved her, actually, when she was only 6 weeks old from an abusive home in West Kensington.
Did he just pop his head over the fence? How did he know what happened?
No, it was actually a sort of ne'er-do-well type house. And there was a cat there, and it was always starved and kicked around.
And this was Noonie.
And so one day we asked them where the cat was, because we'd bought some chicken, and they didn't know. And they said they hadn't seen it for 4 days, so we just searched, and it was just sitting outside the flat, one floor up. So Roland just put it inside his leather jacket, and we got a taxi home. And she lived for another 23 years.
And also, you put Noonie on a plane from.
Yes,
was it Paris to Melbourne or London to Melbourne?
Well, she'd been in Paris, but she
on a weekender. Romantic weekender with you and Rolly?
We're about 3 weeks, I think.
Okay.
And then, they're very good with pets in France, or they were, but not so much in Australia. We had to, get her put in quarantine at both ends. So,
both ended quarantine?
Yeah, so she really refused to like us by the time we got her out of there.
How did we meet?
How did we meet?
Yeah.
Oh, I remember seeing you a couple of times. I saw you once outside the Cherry Bar somewhere late at night. And I remember a pair of fishnet stockings and a great pair of legs.
Oh, dear. This is sounding very early thousands if there's fishnets involved. Fishnets and a bad boy.
Yeah.
That's sounding very early thousands.
And then I met you via Conrad, who is a boyfriend that we both shared.
Yeah, so we have shared my husband. Genevieve was dating Conrad before I was dating Conrad. And I've never, with any boyfriend I've ever had and they've got an ex, things can get a little spicy.
They usually are.
And but this was really different for me and you.
Yeah.
It was like we welcomed each other into the family.
Yes, I actually couldn't have picked someone better for Conrad. I mean, Conrad was much younger than me, although, you know, I hasten to add that this wasn't at the same time as I was with Roland. We'd broken up.
But you might have still been living with Roland.
Yes, we were still living together. Yes, okay. Conrad is... I didn't even know he was a bass player then. I just thought he was an incredibly great human being. And and then he said one day, "I play bass, you know," and I thought, "Oh, yeah." And then I heard him play and I thought, Jesus, he's play bass.
He's a very good bass player. Yeah.
And he had all the same taste in music. He had excellent taste in music. And he was very funny and very intelligent.
And Roland and Conrad.
It's similar, the four
of us actually. There's Conrad and Jen, myself and Conrad, and the four of us were a bit of a pack.
Yeah.
I feel like... if one of us went into 7-Eleven to get a Coke, the others would start barking. We needed to be together.
We needed to be in the pack.
Yeah.
And we just all got each other, I think.
We all got each other, very much so.
And we all, I think, liked and admired each other. Yeah, and were sort of fascinated. Well, I was fascinated anyway. Yeah. Yes, both Roland and Conrad are really easy people to be around, I think, which, you know, was one of the wonderful things. And
how did you first lay your eyes on Roland? What happened?
Going to gigs I'd come down from Brisbane. I had been here a couple of years maybe or a year and a half.
So you were... you grew up in Brisbane.
I lived in Melbourne until I was four or something in Prahran, and then we went to Brisbane and I stayed there. And then when I was 16, I left home. I went
I
to uni when I was really
paradise.
Young. There was no surface paradise involved. I was a little bit of a surfy chick when I was 13, I think. Always had a suntan and long blonde hair, but that didn't last long. Came down to Melbourne and met a girl called Mari Hoy, and we formed a sort of band together, and she was a great singer. And together we started going out to see various bands, and one of them was The Boys Next Door, and the other one were the Young Charlatans, which was Roland's first band, who were just fantastic. They were like a sort of like the Boys Next Door, who were the early birthday party, Nick and Mick and Phil and Tracy, but with an edge and with a sort of intelligent lyrics, you know, because
at
that
stage... Yeah, they were a bit
witty.
Like one recording lying around?
Yeah, there is. There's a... but it's unfortunately, it's a recording from rehearsal, so it sounds really bad. And I don't know, we've thought about putting it out, but it just doesn't do
them
justice, you know.
Yeah.
And their songs were incredibly catchy. You know, there was a lot of sort of a bit of Roxy music, sort of David Bowie television. And then their hit song was Shivers, which Roland had already written.
Of course, yeah.
Because he wrote that when he was 16. And he was about 16 at this time. And, you know, I was 18 or so. So I thought, you know, I was much older and more mature. But
In saying that, some of the lyrics are, they're quite teenage in a way, but they're also, they've got some adult feelings for a 16-year-old.
Yeah, they do. And he was just so gorgeous. I mean, I thought he was sort of like a matinee idol or something. And Roland sort of pursued me. I was with someone else and he was just always there and always ready to take, you know, to make sure that I got home okay and just being really kind. And we'd stay up all night sometimes if I was by myself and just talk about music and books and whatever. And then I thought one day, God, why aren't I in love with someone like this? So, no, Roland wasn't vain, and that was so good in those days because, you know, a lot of people were getting a little bit obsessed with their appearance or, you know.
Why do you think that was? Why wasn't he vain? Because he's spectacular looking.
I don't know. Yeah. He just didn't get that he was good looking. He thought he had big ears and a big nose and that he was far too long. And
so was he slightly insecure behind the scenes in private with you?
He wasn't really insecure. He was just sort of oblivious. He just sort of, if you say anything, he'd say, oh, God, don't be stupid. And look at my eyes. They're all hoodie. And and look at this nose. And he'd twist his nose to the side and sort of put on. But in the morning, he had really great tasting clothes and he looked after them. So he'd just get dressed. He always sort of ironed his shirts and I really liked that about him.
He did look after his clothes,
in fact,
didn't he?
The first thing I ever said to Roland was, who irons your shirts? And he said, I do, of course. And I thought, I like this boy.
Right.
And
So who said I love you first?
He told me. Right, from near the beginning, he said he was in love with me. And I thought he couldn't be. And I just brushed it off. And then I said I wasn't ready for another relationship. And then I went to Sydney and realised how much I missed him and came back and we went for a walk.
Did you run along the beach in slow motion?
No, but we sat on the pier in St Kilda and looked out to sea. And I said I was feeling strangely depressed and he said, let's go back to your place and draw. The lights went and he was on the table and I told him then, you know, I just realised I'm smitten. And wow. I took him outside because McCarvey was there with us.
So you need some privacy.
So
you took him outside, I'm on the edge of my seat.
Yeah. And then we had to go out to dinner with McCarvey and we sat there and held hands under the table. I don't know why we didn't want to tell Mick.
Well, it's just,
we thought he'd disapprove. He told me Roland was too young for me. So anyway, we started playing music together at home. Yeah, so I'd play the piano and Roland would come and sit there. At first I played guitar and Roland would play guitar and
Electric guitar?
Yeah.
So you weren't all kind of Bob Dylan?
Yeah. I had some really bad Yamaha SG copy or something. And
where did you get that guitar from? Can you remember?
Yes, I bought it and this beautiful acoustic Epiphone from somebody in Clifton Hill.
Isn't that where all the bands played that you didn't get along with?
Yeah, they were the Carlton bands, but they had good.
Okay.
They had good guitars. Yeah, they were sort of the older hippies that we were busy rebelling against.
Because you didn't like that many bands in Melbourne, you lot.
No, and then there was the sort of, the post-punk scene, but it was really divided in Melbourne. It was like, I don't know, there were people who thought that the Boys Next Door were, you know, this or that, or there were people, it would depend on which side of the river you were from, there was this sort of divide.
Like, yeah, there's a huge...
East and West Germany.
If you're not from Melbourne, there is a north and south of the river divide. It's because we don't have any adjoining countries that we have to make, you know, these kind of little mini dramas within a microcosmos.
Makeup
of the Yarra River
based on geographical features.
Yeah, and it works for us. Yeah. So anyway.
But the universities were on, there was a, Melbourne University was on the north side, and so there was sort of
yes,
a lot of...
Yes, it is too.
Yeah, intellectual sort of... it wasn't the
was
intellectual
the
thing
in
we...
the south and the intellectuals in the north?
Yeah, yeah, and the hippies in the north. And
the hippies in the north.
Yeah, and the people that nobody knew what we were at that stage in the south. Hadn't really been called punks yet.
Were there any bands you liked?
Well, bands from overseas?
No, from the local scene.
Well, I did used to go and see the Boys Next Door, and they were fun. I loved Young Tarletons. No, there were very few. There was a band called Tsk, which just had symbols, three symbols for their name. There was a really weird band called Jab, who were electronic, the sort of, you know, the pseudo Einstoitz and de Neubauten of Melbourne.
Yep.
That were quite good. But it was basically, and then there was something called, a phenomenon called the little bands, which was just a whole lot of people coming together and doing one-offs, like forming a band for a night. There were very few women. And in fact, when you were a woman and you played music, it sort of seemed to have a sort of divisive effect with other women. I couldn't really work it out. Yeah.
Lot of judgment?
Like, who do you think you are? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, because I played in this weird little fun band called the Little Cuties, which had Nick Cave, Roland, Tracy Pugh, Mick Harvey, Pierre Voltaire, who was later in the Middles. Yeah.
And were you playing keys in that band?
No, Nick played keys, what? And I played Tracy's bass, like a stand-up bass.
No way. Oh, wow.
And sometimes I played guitar. I played a really cool lead break in Hall of Mirrors. We did cover songs, yeah. So we did sort of Roxy Music songs and Kraftwerk songs and we're in with the in crowd because we enjoyed it. We played at parties and we supported the first Boys Next Door gig.
Roland, no exaggeration, was the first person outside my own band who made me feel equal.
Yes.
and then made me question my own perception of self.
Yes. And he did that to me as well. That's a good point, Tony, because he just had this way about him of encouraging the people who he believed in.
Yeah, and without being over the top, it was super subtle encouragement where it was like he would get into your own DNA and you could self self-fix.
Yeah.
Like a chiropractor.
And he just had no doubt about it, you know, about you.
Yeah.
And he did that for me. He always encouraged me and he couldn't believe that I had self-doubt. And he'd say, Jen, just put a record out. You write great songs. You're mad.
Yeah.
Mad.
We're like that with you too, though.
Yeah. Well,
didn't
I
you
am
say, I can't
mad.
Believe you're not famous. This is so embarrassing.
Yeah. He's always had that sort of androgynous feel about him, and he doesn't go around spouting feminist philosophy or anything. He just totally believes that women are equal.
It's in the actions.
And he believes that anyone can be whatever they, try to be, and that, you know, you've just got to do it and just...
He was all about just do it. Like even when if you asked him any advice on guitar, I've even read Roland in interviews who would say, just plug it in and go.
Yeah. I had this old reel-to-reel machine that was for mixing 4-track down to 2-track, but it had a sound on sound button. So we could record tracks over tracks over tracks, building up the sound with just a bit of delay. And so it just ended up this Phil Spector wall of sound. And that's when Roland first started getting into sound as well as melody and rhythm. So the sound became more important to him. And after that, he just grew exponentially in, and within months, he was making the most incredible sounds.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what year did this happen, roughly?
78.
Oh, my God, 78. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
78 and 79. Yeah.
And you were still in Melbourne at this point?
Yeah.
And what was the catalyst for you to all, as you all moved together, like maybe six of you or something like that?
A pack.
Yeah, yeah. A pack of wolves, St Kilda Wolves, moved from Melbourne to straight to, did you stop over in Berlin before London or
no,
straight to London?
No, so we didn't all go together. So the boys went first and the girlfriends made their own way there.
And who were the girlfriends? It was yourself, Anita Lane.
Anita Lane, Katie Beale, who is Nick's mixed partner. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, Katie's fantastic.
And Caitlin, who was Tracy Pugh's partner.
Oh, okay.
And we all ended up in, I went to Amsterdam first because I had to get a cheap ticket and it went to Amsterdam, and then I got something called the Magic Bus for 10 quid from hippiedom to dowerdom in London. I couldn't believe how grey and cold it was. And it was a real shock to the system, actually, going from St Kilda to London.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
From sunny beachside
wow,
Australia.
From surface paradise to. What suburb or area were you living in London? Where did you first?
Fulham.
Fulham, okay.
Yeah. Oh, the first place we were in was in Earl's Court, and there were 10 of us in a one bedroom flat.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah. Wow. So I slept on the couch with Roland and. And we'd sort of sleep up the same end, and then during the night we'd get so uncomfortable that I'd end up with Roland's feet in my face the next morning. Nick slept in the entrance hall. Tracy slept in the hallway, and Mick and Phil ended up with a single bed each in the one bedroom. But then they were girlfriends as well, so it was just unbelievable. I remember Barry Adamson telling me that we were barbarians as well because he couldn't believe that we all wore each other's clothes
you
and didn't ask. And yeah, just borrowed and
net singlets and cowboy hats. Where was all that kind of costume happen? It was around at that point, or did that come a bit later?
That was a little bit later, but it was getting there. I mean, Tracy was getting ever more village people. One thing that's for sure is that the birthday party did not have an image as such. Everybody looked totally different. You know, Phil looked a bit preppy. Mick Harvey looked like an Australian stockman. Roland looked like Roland. Nick looked like, you know, I don't know, Nick, the Black Crow. And he was always borrowing my shirts and jumpers to wear on stage, and they'd be completely ripped to pieces by the audience. But at first it was hard in London because people didn't get the band, and reviews would say things about cork hats and kangaroos. And
I understand. We had a bit of that when Hate Rock first moved to London. We were reminiscing about myself and Nigel, my bandmate, really miss the English reviews because Australians don't write that way, full of like humour and mockery.
Yes.
And spite and wit.
Yes.
Even a bad review is great.
Yeah.
Our manager used to be like, congratulations, someone hates you.
Mm.
you're polarising.
Roland looked like a bandicoot and sang like one too.
Can you remember what bands you were, I guess the thing about London I remember as well is that you're kind of up against the other bands. So what bands were you up against at the time? It was very competitive.
It was, but because we were colonials, it was like we were on a completely different
dimension.
So, and the bands that we really liked that we went to see and like, we went out the first night and saw A Certain Ratio and Psychedelic Furs and A Teardrop Explosion. We were absolutely horrified. Sorry. Absolutely devastated that they were the band.
Roland reject Pet Shop Boys on cassette once from being signed? Is that a rumour?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he was the A&R person for Mute Records, and he never recommended a single thing. And one of them was Pet Shop Boys, but he really liked Pet Shop Boys later. Yeah. He thought they were great. Yeah. And then they started playing at places like the Moonlight Club in West Hampstead. 4AD got involved, and this man, Ivo Watts, appeared out of the grim grey and with his shock of blonde hair and was just really lovely, and Cherry Red and 4AD were really good.
Did he turn
up
to a show?
Yeah. And they put out a single called Mr. Clarinet, and that went well, and A Friend Catcher. And there were various things that went along the way, and then records came out, and then all of a sudden it just exploded. They went to New York, took a journalist with them, or he came with them, and I think he went with them to, you know, dash them and ended up adoring them.
Wow, I like that a lot.
And then they were on the cover of Enemy and Sounds and, yeah, got the middle spread, and they were the best thing since Jesus Christ and et cetera. Crucifixion. But yeah, that really helped having a record company, and it was the first record company we'd ever seen who we actually saw them pay people. Mm. You know, like money didn't just disappear into a big hole in the ground, never to be seen again.
Tell me, how did These Immortal Souls form?
Well, after the birthday party, or sort of. Yeah, after the birthday party, Crime in the City Solution started, and Roland and Mick and Harry and Epic Soundtracks, the drummer, were all playing with Simon Bonney, singer, and mostly in Berlin and going on tour in London. And then Crime sort of went on, got some really just let Harry, Epic and Roland go without telling them. The first they knew that they weren't in the band was seeing that they were playing in Berlin that weekend and not hearing anything about it. So Roland was not happy about that and decided to start his own band. Yeah.
Something he could control. I wonder, do you know why that ended so abruptly and weirdly?
I think it was just half the band were living in Berlin and half were in London. It was just too difficult. Yeah. And also, if you have Germans in your band, you get supported by the German Kultur Institute. So, yeah.
And so, who came up with the name These Immortal Souls?
It was just the name of one of our songs. And Roland, we got killed for having that name. Like, you know, people thought it was so pretentious, but it was just the name
larger,
of the song.
Bigger than Jesus,
kind of. Yeah, like, who did John think Lennon. You are? Or, like, what, vampires or something? It's just a bloody name, but because it had a these, why not the? Why not the? Why these? I don't get it. But that was the sort of thing Roland did. He'd have two names for a song and put one in brackets, or he'd... You know,
yeah, he did do that.
Yeah, they were always. He was always having conversations with himself.
Yes, and he liked a twist or a double meaning.
Yes, he did. Because, like, marry me, lie, lie.
Yes, because the album that he co-produced for my band was the album Marry Me Tonight.
Yeah,
and a years later, after that album had been out and things like that. Roland said, it just occurred to me that, you know, all this time I've been working out what the twist or the double meaning is of Marry Me Tonight, and the twist is there's no twist. you just meant it. And he looked perplexed and disappointed.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, I just meant it.
Mm.
And he also could not believe that we didn't put a photo of ourselves on the cover.
Yes, he thought that was a really lost... He said, we're the band that looks like that, for God's sake.
That's nice to hear.
Put yourself on the cover. Why did they put themselves on the cover?
Yeah.
He thought that was a lost opportunity, but then he also really liked that pink and red cover.
Those were very Roland colours.
Yeah.
I guess, listen, we were really in awe of Roland when he was in the producer's chair at Birdland Studios, and he'd walk in with a blue Powerade and like a tropical long sleeve shirt. He'd kind of roll in about 4 p.m.
Yeah.
We'd been there from 8 a.m. sometimes overnight.
Mm.
Yeah, Roland would come in really fresh, almost quite chipper, actually, and was really kind of blew out of the water, this vampiric idea that we had of Roland.
Yeah, I know. He's not like he looks.
Yeah, but he was more mysterious for it, for not playing into the stereotype of the kind of gothic guitar hero.
No, he didn't have the 5,000-yard stare when he was with people. Yeah. You know, he wasn't at all self-involved or superior. Bloody fantastic personality, really. I mean, he obviously had faults, as we all do, but
I don't think he really did, though.
No, that's what I was going to say. They're all mythical. They're just faults of morality, which aren't faults. They're just other people's judgments. He was really inclusive. He thought women were great. He always thought women wrote better words and sang more poignantly.
Did he?
Yeah.
Because that's one thing I love about Roland's work is how you believe what he's saying, just thinking about being poignant or authentic or...
Well, he couldn't not write about himself. I mean, there were some birthday party songs he wrote when he was writing for Nick to sing that he stopped writing from his own point of view. But his songs were usually romantic or they were about what he was feeling. And, you know, he'd write these songs and like Dead Radio or something, and then he'd give it to me to read. And he'd say, and by the way, I put something about your tetracycline overdose in it, but,
Yeah, there's so many Jen references.
Yeah, so please don't get upset. You're not going to get upset, are you? And then he'd say to me, so what do you think I'm trying to say? And I'd think, oh, my God, it's so obvious. How do you not know what you're trying to say?
Well, I think that's because sometimes the person closest to you, which was you at the time, knows you better than you know yourself.
Mm.
And you kind of become one person. And you and Roland, you know, even in the last years of Roland, you had become one body.
Do you think?
Yeah.
But he wrote masses. Like after he died, there were just so many spiral sort of fool's cap notebooks full. And they're all at the music vault now.
What's the music vault?
The music vault is a great thing in Victoria associated with the Art Centre, and it's right next door to the National Gallery of Victoria, and they started collecting things that they think are important to music, and they've got Roland's guitar.
Oh, I did know that, but yeah. They've got all his notebooks and scrapbooks.
And they've got all his notebooks and lyric books. Wow. And so anybody can actually apply to go in and see them. If you're a writer
Excuse me while I make an appointment.
Unfortunately, some of them have got really personal things in them, like letters that he wrote to someone or to me. And one really embarrassing letter he wrote to me after we'd had a fight, you know, saying something like, well, it's in there, so I may as well say, just because you cry and I don't doesn't mean that I'm not hurting as much as you. And I thought, oh, no.
No, there's nothing nothing embarrassing there.
No, but, I mean, it sort of is. Because Roland wrote letters to people. They never sent them. Like if he was angry about something, his way of getting through it was to write a letter and then never send it. But he didn't, like in his life, he didn't separate life from art or life from music. So his lyrics and everything that he wrote for posterity are in the same books as these letters. And
do you think he had
book reviews and
an awareness of the mythology of himself, even as a younger person.
I think he had an awareness of saving things for posterity because, you know, when he wrote Shivers and everything, he'd write it all out and then
it's so neat put and the signed date. And yeah. dated and
yeah.
Where did that come from?
So we've got two copies, and one of them's when he's 16 and the other's a month after he turns 17. And I know Roland, and I know he'd write something and then he'd rewrite it out properly. You know what I mean.
In case someone was to find it.
Yeah. But all the Young Charlatans lyrics are written out in this big blue book and most of the birthday party lyrics, and they're just really good, you know, for someone that young. Like, God, he was so well read, you know, he just absorbed.
When would be your things. Reading times together? Because you're also
Roland read about three books a week, I think, probably, right through his life. And I've always read.
You probably read two or three.
Yeah.
Were you early risers and wake up and read and have a cup of coffee, or would it be like late in the night?
We'd wake up early and Rolly would go and get coffees and sometimes, you know, pastries or something. And then we'd read in bed and then we'd go back to sleep. And then we'd also sort of go to bed really late. But after we'd been asleep for a few hours, we'd wake up and have a cup of tea. And that was some of the best times of my life because he was hilarious in the middle of the night, Roland. He was so relaxed and so funny. And I'd just be, like, doubled over having laughing fits. It was so good. That's something I really miss.
Roland had just such a wealth of songs that his friends, dear friends and collaborators, played with joy. I think it started off in St Kilda at the MIMO.
It did. It did in, I think it was 2013, and Mick and I had wondered about it, whether it was possible, and getting sort of all these people involved like you and Conrad and
Brian
Harry,
Hooper.
Brian Hooper, people that Roland had played with, Mick Harvey, of course, J.P. Shiloh, who played on Pop Crimes, and
Adelita,
and Ed Cooper
Hugo
from
Race.
The Saints, Ed Cooper from True Spirit, who also...
Tim Howden. I met Roland at...
Ding Dong.
At Ding Dong?
Yeah, I was
there. A club
there.
Called Ding Dong. Were you there?
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord.
Except I was a bit... I was giving him room so he could switch. And I knew he was intrigued.
We supported Roland that night.
Yeah.
We were the support band for everyone back then. This is 2005. 2003 to 2005, we're always supporting someone, and we supported
and
Roland.
And a great support band.
We were a pretty good support band, and we had supported Roland a bunch of times. Roland came over to me after we finished a Hate Rock show, and he complimented my navy floral pantsuit.
That's right. I remember that pantsuit.
That was equally as exciting, that compliment, as Roland then saying that he would like to produce an album for us. And I, you know, I kind of gasped and just said what a huge fan that I was, and I was so glad that he liked our show. He was super charming, super sweet. Mm-hmm. And then all I could think was, I have to tell Sean and Nigel. And I'm running around Ding Dong trying to find them. I couldn't find them anywhere. Finally, I find them backstage, and Roland had told us all separately, the three of us.
Oh, my God.
And
okay.
We all had the news for each other, and we were over the moon.
Yeah.
We were really happy.
He loved watching you. He really liked music. He thought you were great.
Yeah, that's wild. Because we were a little, to use an overused review word, polarizing when back then. People would either, put their fingers in their ears and run or come really close. And but it was amazing to have Roland like us. That was wild.
And then what was it like to have him write a song?
I think we were in a cafe in St Kilda called Pelican.
Oh, we were.
Yeah, and
yes.
He asked if I'd like to do a duet with him on his forthcoming solo album that he was putting together. He had some songs.
Yeah.
And he was putting together. And, of course, I was like, of course I would love to do this. But, yeah, Roland then became, not Roland my friend, but I had some self, almost like some self-doubt, like, can I pull this off? Yeah.
It would
sneak in that am I able to write a song with Roland S. Howard?
It was such a great song. It is such a great song.
Yeah, and then we had another little date down at Pelican, and that's when Roland presented me with very neat handwriting of the whole song. In fact, I have it here on the wall, which was the chorus and a couple of verses, and then little arrows and gaps for where I would fill in my parts, and I would write about him, and the song worked out really, really well. I know that again, he gave me so much confidence when we were recording it at Birdland.
Yeah. I donated one line to that song.
Which line?
Astronaut's Dress.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
That's so you.
Because you came over to dinner once when Roland cooked some really tragic pasta. I don't know what had gone wrong. I think we'd forgotten about it because we were having such a good time talking. And John had worn this amazing silver dress, and I'd said, oh, it's an astronaut's dress. You look like you're an astronaut. And Roland put astronaut's dress in your astronaut's dress in the song.
That's cute.
Mm. He said to me, she's changing all the boys into girls. Changing all the girls into boys, meaning that all the girls were falling in love with you. Yeah, that you had the ability to make people fall in love with you.
I didn't know that.
And so that's what he meant by changing all the girls and boys into girls and changing all the girls into boys.
Yeah, the Pop Crimes band, we did a couple of shows in France, then we ended in London at Festival Hall to a sold-out show.
Yeah, South Bank.
Nick Cave joined in South Bank. Nick Cave joined that show as well. He just did Shivers as a solo
and that was great.
On piano.
Yeah.
With like a single spotlight lighting him up. And that was super cool.
And Bobby Gillespie did Exit Everything and Shut Me Down.
Did he do
Autoluminescent? Yeah.
He did a great job of that. And Bobby, because it was a festival hall, is a seated venue, and Bobby pulled out the pop star.
Yeah, he got everybody up.
He got everybody up with like a click. I'm clicking here with a click of his hands. Yeah, the crowd basically like jumped the stage, and it became a rock show. It was amazing.
Thank God for Bobby Gillespie.
Yeah, and Lydia was another person, Lydia Lunch, who you realise that you're in the company of a pop star.
Yeah.
Or a rock star, would it, you know. But I like to say pop star because they embody pop culture and Roland love pop.
And pop crimes and
pop
culture.
Yeah, pop crimes, yeah.
And just the word pop. There's a whole lot of good things about
Roland
the word
pop. Roland loved
pop. He did, yeah.
And
pop culture, comics, you know, just he had a massively brilliant comic collection that was the envy of people worldwide.
He wrote. He's completest. Also written a comic, hasn't he? Did he write a comic? Or,
yes, he did.
Has he also written? He's got an unpublished novel,
he's
or maybe a film.
He's got two unpublished novels. One's called Etcetracide, and one's called Insomnicide.
Did you say Etcetracide?
Yeah. Etcetracide.
Etcetracide. And Insomnicide.
Mm. And they're both set in Melbourne, London, Berlin, and New Orleans.
Oh.
Yeah, I have. They're great. In fact, in the film Autoluminescent, JP's reading from Roland's book.
Ah, he is too.
At the beginning, and
yeah,
it's beautiful.
He is too.
Yeah. Beautiful words.
JP Shiloh from Hungry Ghosts, and obviously a solo artist, was and is Roland.
Yeah, he plays amazing guitar like Roland. He's sort of worked out note for note.
He's worked out
really,
all the nuances.
Sound for sound.
It's quite interesting to see Harry, who is Roland's DNA, play some of the Roland songs, and you're like, wow, it really is Roland's voice effortlessly because he's his brother. And then JP he comes in from a different angle, which he has like a master. He's studied Roland and is almost like a seance summoning the ghost.
Yeah.
It's and everyone else really brings, I guess, their own.
And he's a completist, I think, JP. He, you know, he studies it to such a degree.
He's a perfectionist.
Yeah, he
for
is.
Sure. Yeah, it's quite amazing to work on the Pop Crimes tour, because Mick also to some degree is also slightly kind of going with the flow, but is very
loose but very tight.
Loose but tight.
Yeah.
Loose but tight,
yeah,
Mick.
That's the best thing you can be.
Yeah.
Loose but tight.
And, you know, I guess that's what everyone is, but it's a drive and a passion to bring the songs to life for the fans in the way that they appeared on record.
But, I mean, what I loved about those tours was just the sheer amount of enjoyment and good feeling and camaraderie and empathy and playing with Brian, and then we lost Brian
Yeah, Brian
Spencer
was amazing.
Spencer Jones there, who was someone else who played in These Immortal Souls for a while. Who
I think we all realise as a collective that, you know, any of us could go at any moment, and it is a real luxury to be together.
Sort of in a borrowed realm, really.
Yeah, but you're right.
But
yeah,
Roland
really
certainly has left a lasting impact, you know, and it's just because he was so honest, I think, in his writing, you know, both musically. He didn't try to be like anything. He just was himself. He didn't try to be like anything else. And he just wrote what he thought sounded good, and his words, like the words for A Girl Called Johnny, aren't like anything else. I know yours are great too, you know. It's there's so many songs of his that are just got so many smaller emotions in there, and so many double backs and twists, and but just so much feeling, heartfelt, and it's beautiful.
Also quite teenage.
Yeah.
He kept that teenage fire.
Yeah, he loved
fire,
teenage, yeah.
Till, you know, well into his 40s.
Yeah. He loved teenagers because they embodied curiosity and
they're just pure
life
emotion, aren't they?
Yeah, and yeah, pure emotion, and you're not set yet. You know, nothing's set in stone. You're malleable and fluid, and you haven't quite decided, and you're full of hope.
You're like that too.
But I never stop. I don't think a single day ever goes past where I don't think of Roland for quite some time. You know.
How does Roland manifest in your everyday life now?
That's hard to say. Sometimes I just downright miss him, you know, as a companion. But mostly as I hear his voice as an encouragement, you know, and a thing to just do it, and I've got to just do it and stop.
Yep, I have that too. I remember you said to me, Jen, that if there was an afterlife, Roland would work out how to manipulate it so he could come and say hello to you, even just once.
Yes.
And I think that in a way he has manipulated the afterlife, and I believe in it now because he does talk to us.
Yes, he
with
does.
Encouragement. I feel it. I feel it all the time. I feel that our relationship has continued.
Yeah,
it's I feel like we still have our friendship going and that encouragement.
Yeah,
that you were saying, like, just do it, just get it done.
Yeah,
it's not that hard.
Yeah. And at least
don't think, just do it.
Yeah, just do it. Like, what are you going to do if you don't do it?
Yeah.
Nothing. Nothing's going to happen. So, and also when I walk down his laneway, I always imagine him, because we used to often meet each other. I'd be coming home from work or something and he'd be on his way out down to the shop or something, and I'd see him coming from the other end of the alleyway. In that sort of silhouette, nobody else, and he'd always put his arms out, and so whenever I'm down and I need a bit of encouragement, I imagine a good old Roland hug, you know. There's always Lossett in his in his big warm
coat.
Yeah,
that's lovely.
Yeah.
Thanks so much to Janine and Genevieve for sharing all their Roland stories with us. We hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have. Episode 2 will land next month with guests Dave Lovering and Michael Bennett, aka The Nugget Noggin.